Bob Harris was a freelance reporter who was hired to review some of the world's most luxurious hotels for ForbesTraveler.com. It was a dream job until he met some of the oppressed workers whose labor made that opulence possible. He invested all the earnings he made from the job into microloans around the world through an organization called Kiva, and then he decided to follow his investments, meet some of the recipients of those loans, and see how their lives were changed by small amounts of money. And he describes what he learned in his new book, The International Bank of Bob. It's published by Walker & Company. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lynn.
So how do you get a job like that from Forbes?
The short version, which isn't completely accurate, but it's close enough for radio, is that I met the right editor and we drank well together. And I didn't have to choose the hotels. They were chosen for me. The editors had already done all that. Sophisticated people had done that. They just needed a guy to actually go to the hotels, not break anything or cause an international incident, and, you know, make my deadlines. And so I...
Let me describe what you found.
Oh, yeah. Just show up and basically say, yeah, this is pretty nice.
Were you traveling incognito, or did the resorts understand that you'd be writing about them for Forbes?
That was the other thing. There was no secret thing about it, whatever. They knew I was coming because they knew they were already on the Forbes list. So I'd show up, I'd hand them a business card, and then out came, you know, hot and cold running caviar and things on trays, and it was completely insane.
But perhaps you were being treated better than other guests might.
Probably, but I don't know how much. I mean, at a place like the Emirates Palace in Abu Dhabi, where heads of state stay, I mean, I don't think I was even getting close to what their top was.
Well, you didn't bring all of your wives.
No, I didn't. I thought we weren't going to talk about my legal matters.
How long did you stay at each resort?
Usually it was just like 3 or 4 days.
And did you just travel from one opulent place to another in an extended vacation?
Yes, month after month in the summer of 2008. That was my dreary life.
And what were the most outrageous luxuries you were treated to?
Oh, you know, I think the one that really stopped me was supposedly the finest coffee in the world is made from the poop, if I may say, of an Indonesian civet that eats the coffee beans, digests them. Something magic happens with its enzymes, and it then releases back into the wild the world's richest coffee.
Kopi Luwak.
Kopi Luwak.
Kopi Luwak.
Yeah. Yeah. And which is, in fact, I will tell you in all honesty, the most delicious thing I've ever had that came out of another creature, which is a very short list.
And you say that you had a drink that cost more than your car?
I did not actually have that drink. I witnessed said drink. I saw its existence. In one of the bars there in Dubai. They have a brandy, I think it is. But you get to take the tumbler home, like Chuck E. Cheese.
Oh, you get a whole bottle.
You get to keep the cup. It's just a shot, but you keep the cup.
Uh-huh. So, and how much does that cost?
It was like $7,000 or $8,000. It was something like that.
And people buy it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, people have no idea what money's for.
So, well, if you have the money, it doesn't hurt if you have billions.
No.
Okay, something that costs $10,000 is the same as me $10.
Right. It's pennies to you, but ultimately there's a point where opulence just loses all meaning.
Well, what about that coffee, Kopi Luwak? Would you want to have it again?
It was delicious. I think I've done it once. I think I'd be ready to move on to – I'll wait for the next fantastic animal coffee.
You do some comparative economics between the cost of various treats on your trip and the wages people earned who served mm-hmm. the tourists in both the legal and the illegal economies. Can you give us a few examples?
Let's see. I mean, at the top of my head, most of the people who, for example, in the Emirates, they were making an average of $6 or $7 a day, something like that. So, you could just do the math if you're dealing. Let's not make it to the crazy extent of stuff, but just, you know, people going into the 5-star hotels there and having a, by those standards, relatively conservative business dinner would be spending, you know, $200 easily, you know, which is. And let's say the guys are making, you know, $10 a day. Fine, that's 3 weeks' wages.
Well, I don't understand why, if a place is charging so much money, mm-hmm. They're paying so little to their workers. Is it because they can?
I believe that was the answer. Yeah, they can. I think that's part of why it was so profitable.
So do you think that it's morally wrong to vacation in places like this?
That's an interesting question. I debate it. I think to the best extent that you're capable of staying in places where, like, for example, Dubai, pretty much most of the properties seem to be owned by the government. And I can't tell you, I haven't researched it lately in the last couple of years. Maybe their policies have gotten better or something. But if it's the same as it was in 2008, yeah, I wouldn't think it's a great thing. But you can go to a place like Bali, where a lot of the money, a lot of the same stuff's happened. You've still got very poor people serving you in very rich hotels. But you can stay in locally owned hotels that cost a tiny fraction. You can, you know, eat at local restaurants that cost a tiny fraction. And you can actually go and have an amazing time and really spend time with the locals and do it in an amazingly ethical way.
On the other hand, if these places weren't there, many of those people wouldn't have a job.
That's true. That's true. It's not something that has, like, some easy ideological answer.
Your qualms began in Dubai. So what were the workers' lives like there?
As near as I could tell, I mean, I didn't, go undercover or anything, but, and according to international reports, Human Rights Watch, stuff like that, basically they're working 10, 12, you know, longer hours per day, six, sometimes 7 days a week. The heat there is, maybe 105 and humid. So with the heat index figure 110, 115, I was there during Ramadan and I was given to believe that, some of these folks they didn't even have access to water during daylight hours, some of them. I don't know whether that's actually true or not, but I found it credible. And they're living 10 to a head out in not air-conditioned camps out in the desert that aren't even on tourist maps. And they're never even going to see the inside of the buildings that, you know, that they're building. And this resonated for me, and part of the reason that this turned things for me, and in a way this is maybe incredibly presumptuous, but look, we've got poverty here too, maybe because I was taken completely out of my own element and surrounded with, I had my eyes open. And maybe because of the sheer magnitude of the difference in rich and poor there.
Well, you're eating pastries that have gold on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Emirates Palace bragged to me that they go through 5 kilos, 11 pounds of pastry, of gold, fresh gold every year. Not in doing the walls. That's just in pastry decorations. So that's like, I don't know, that's $400,000, $500,000 that they're just... You know, gold's indigestible, so they're literally throwing it down the toilet.
But the people who are working in these places mm-hmm. aren't locals, are they?
No.
In Bali, they would be,
yes.
I would assume. Are they paid better when they work at the local hotels?
Comparing between Bali and Dubai, I'd have to say that it's probably still fairly similar. In Dubai, because of the local living standards, and I'd have to do some math, in Dubai, the workers, and not just Dubai, this is in, you know, all of the Gulf states, most of the Gulf states, I should say, they're coming from South Asia, from Southeast Asia, from East Africa, and they're essentially the modern equivalent of indentured servants. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they sign up to do this, by the way, and this is the heartbreaking part, is, I mean, they haven't been grabbed off of some boat and forced to do this. They've signed up to do this for years at a time.
Knowing that they're going to be treated so poorly?
They've made a bunch of promises that aren't kept. I don't think they realize quite what they're getting into. But they've got families at home that they're trying to support. And where they're from, maybe they can only make $2 a day, maybe $3 a day. So six or seven, now you got some walking around money. They can, you know, take care of themselves very cheaply. And then they're sending the money home, that extra few dollars a day to their families. They're in this hell because they love their kids.
But they also have no rights. I remember reading about people who wanted to vote in some of these areas or complained about the way they were being treated. They had no legal rights as well. Mm-hmm. So they are really in a bad situation. Can they just pick up and go back home?
No. They're under contract. Actually, a lot of times after they arrive, the passports are taken from them. And so they're pretty much stuck there for the duration of the word is almost an obscenity to use it this way, contract.
You'd hope that you'd find some inspiration in Bali, given the spiritual nature mm-hmm. of the place, did you?
Not so much. Bali is an incredibly beautiful place that I highly recommend people visit. Like any country that is where the economy has had massive dislocation because of Western investment in some parts of the island. I mean, you can, in a very short drive, go from lush, you know, St. Regis Hotel tourist resorts, you know, that cost insane amounts of money. And, you know, on the other side of the island, people are still living essentially at a 19th century standard. And in that dislocation, a lot of times you have people who just want to get their piece of the action. And understandably, but this leads, of course, to every sort of illicit activity that we could name. drugs, prostitution, et cetera.
And you say that Bali's unique culture has attracted many of its problems.
Well, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't have attracted all these tourist hotels if it wasn't so darn beautiful in the first place. And the Balinese Hinduism is a very unique cultural thing where, like, virtually everything is sort of a prayer. It really does have this deep spirituality to it. And I get why people go and do yoga there. I get it. I see it. But because of that, then you've got these giant hotels and tons of money coming in and flying right back out of the island.
My guest is Bob Harris, who's written a book called The International Bank of Bob, Connecting Our Worlds, One $25 Kiva Loan at a Time. Do you think that your family background made you not the best person for Forbes to be sending out?
I think actually in some ways it made me the best guy to send out. I get what you're driving at. My dad was a GM employee. He worked in a warehouse in near Cleveland for 37 years. And my mom worked in a Five and Dime. I grew up working class. And to this day, my favorite food is Cheerios. Now, Forbes could certainly have sent somebody who would have understood all of the words that all the waiters said and who would have, you know, just gone in and swum and nothing would have changed. Now, they would have gotten their reviews, but nothing else would have happened.
Well, did you know the difference between Beluga and Ocetra?
I think Ocetra's got a better shot in the Final Four. Their big men are really strong.
I guess you don't.
Okay. No, I really don't.
So that, I would assume somebody who knew the differences in caviar and things like that might have been more appropriate for this kind of thing.
Well, they might have been, but I mean, these are little 400-word reviews that essentially, you know, were saying, yes, the hotel's nice. I don't think I did any damage.
And I assume that when you're in that kind of situation, you think, well, I'll leave a big tip.
Yeah, actually, I did. In fact, there were a couple of times I actually would raid the minibar in the hotel. Like, you show up as a luxury travel writer, they greet you with a food basket in the room that contains more calories than probably 10 guys working outside get in the day. And, how do I eat? How do I just, you know, shovel that down? You know, you just wind up with this overwhelming impulse that something has gone way out of kilter. And
so you gave the gift basket to the workers.
There was actually one time I did raid a minibar and come down and sit with some guys with whom I had virtually no language in common. And we sat in silence and had this little outdoor picnic in the middle of the night. It was kind of weird and probably more about salving my own conscience than doing any good for them.
But what I get from this book is that you thought handouts were not the right approach.
Well, I mean, there's certainly plenty of it, so more may not be doing more. At the time, in 2008, Muhammad Yunus had just in recent years won the Nobel Peace Prize for microfinance. That looked interesting to me. The other thing, too, that's really been a problem in development and still is sometimes, you know, a lot of solutions come from the, Westerners with academic degrees and so on show up and just say, here's what you need. And they don't necessarily talk to the locals and say, what do you need? And just ask them. Some of the most revolutionary approaches to poverty alleviation have come from someone simply asking, why are you poor? You have a work ethic. You're smart. You know, you're good with your family. This is a strong community. Why are you poor? And listen to the answers.
Do you think that some of the Western reaction to this were influenced by the kinds of things that we saw in the 80s, those Sally Struthers commercials?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, I don't know where the chicken and the egg is in that, but we all remember the Sally Struthers commercials where, and it's sad that her name has almost become instantly synonymous with this kind of sudden surprise commercial break guilt and grief.
She was trying to do good.
Yeah, and I'm sure she did do a lot of good. If she was here, I would just give her nothing but a big hug. But a lot of charity, and long before her, going back to the Jerry Lewis telethon, and it's about pity. It's being driven about, you know, sadness and caring for the vulnerable and the weak and all of that. And the truth is, I mean, you know, we got a billion people on the planet that don't have access to water, but that doesn't mean they don't have self-esteem or that they can't take care of themselves. The truth is, somebody living on $2 or $3 a day, they have to be a heck of a lot more clever than you and me just to get by. They're smart, smart people.
So how did you find Kiva?
I'm not actually capable of remembering everything at once. I had actually heard of them before the Forbes trip. I'd heard a talk given by Premal Shah, the president of Kiva, in San Francisco, and he'd talked about it. And it was this online platform that would allow anybody to just go to kiva.org, you lend $25, zip, off it goes to Zimbabwe, off we go. And I'd thought about it, and I'd looked at it, and I said, gosh, that's awfully neat. And then this Forbes offer came in, and I had some other things going on, and I took the Forbes thing and I went. And I didn't remember the Kiva thing again till the end of the Forbes deal.
And the Kiva thing is pretty much the same sort of thing that Muhammad Yunus is doing, where they lend money to people. Even small amounts seem to obviously help.
Yeah. Kiva is a web platform that works with, I think at the moment it's about 170 different partners in more than 100 countries around the world. And so Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Bank would be a partner. They would be a local field partner in the scheme of things. And in fact, Grameen America is one of Kiva's field partners. Kiva works with partners in just country after country. In the book I go to, Kenya and Bosnia and Cambodia and Vietnam, and there's local Kiva partners in each place. And so they're more – think of Kiva.org as a little bit more like eBay or Craigslist or one of these web platforms where you can access other people's data or stuff. But rather than it being a garage sale like eBay or Craigslist, it's people uploading, hey, I need $400 to finance this cow. And so then we can put $25 to that.
And Muhammad Yunus talks about how he pretty much gets all the money back. People actually repay their loans.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Kiva?
Yeah. The repayment rate Kiva-wide is 99%, plus or minus a tiny speck. My own loans since January of 2009 when I started, the last time I ran the numbers was a couple weeks ago, and my repayment rate has been 99.4%.
Well, you never take the money back, do you?
When it's repaid, people... I recycle it back out into more loans.
Do you think some people do take it back?
Sure. You can withdraw the money if you want to. I use it as my savings account. With today's interest rates, if I go to my bank, I have a big Wall Street bank that I have a checking account at. And if I go to my bank and I put, you know, $25 into a savings account, a year later I got $25 and like 2 pennies or something. And if I put that $25 into Kiva, a year later I've got $25 minus a couple pennies. Mm-hmm. So for the price of a tiny stack of pennies, I get to put my money instead of a Wall Street bank. I get to put it into a Bangladeshi fisherman.
Now, you got dengue fever in one of the fancy hotels.
I did.
So did you have to pay for medical help there?
Actually, dengue, there's not really much you can do medically.
Okay now.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Looks can be deceiving. I was down for like a month and a half with that. It didn't flare up till I gotten back to the U.S. It rode back with me, and I was in Los Angeles. And dengue, by the way, for people who aren't familiar with it, tropical disease affects over 100 million people a year. It can be fatal, mostly kills people in the tropics, particularly on a second case.
And it's worse than malaria, in terms of the numbers that it affects.
It can be really nasty, and the second case can really get you because your body thinks it's fighting it off and it isn't. And that actually was determinative of a lot of the countries that I did and didn't visit for the book because I didn't want to get a second case. So the first place I went was Peru, which is at altitude, and the mosquitoes that carry dengue can't live at that altitude. Dengue, you just ride out. You just you take some acetaminophen and lay on the bed for a month.
So you decided to support Kiva. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do. But the others haven't written a book.
Well, not yet. If this one does well, maybe it'll inspire more. I'm a writer, and I wanted to know whether the things actually worked.
And so it allowed you to travel to find out whether the $25 mm-hmm. that you've been handing out, 25 here, 25 there, actually is having an impact?
Mm-hmm.
And what did you discover?
I would love to be able to sit here and say, well, it's just 100% effective. The fact of the matter is that microfinance, when people ask, does microlending work or not work, it's actually a silly question. It's a tool, like any other tool. Does a hammer work or not work? Well, it depends on the hands of the person using it and what their aim is and how good they are with it. When microfinance is in really good hands and the loan is well designed and the client has some education about how to use the loan, yeah, it works. I saw people's lives change in ways that had happened in really short periods of time, too.
And not just in places like Peru or Africa, mm-hmm. although you can't do it in India for some reason. But Sarajevo, mm-hmm. you went into Sarajevo after the war had
mm-hmm.
ended?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in Sarajevo where I met with what at that time was a local Kiva partner called Women for Women, and I sat with the woman who runs it. And that particular organization doesn't just provide financial tools to the working poor, microfinance and loans and insurance and stuff like that. They also provide all sorts of like emotional support and vocational training and just literacy training and everything you could want to give to women in a post-war environment like that. And I'm sitting there with this lady, Saida Saric, who runs the place, and I mentioned my project, and she said, you have people you want to meet? You have names? And she brightened up, and she immediately gets on the phone, and this is where I met my first the first people I had actually lent to was there in Bosnia.
But as you make the point that you make is that some people use the money better than others.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because some people are more competent than mm-hmm. others or more ambitious.
It can be for a number of reasons. Some people are more competent, more ambitious. Skills are not handed out evenly in the world. Some people simply have a better education in terms of how to use the financing. A lot of it comes down, though, to the people making the loan. If the people making the loan see education and they see, making sure that the client's welfare is a major part of what they do, they tend to succeed much better.
Is it hard to get people to imagine how they can create a better life for themselves?
That's one of the big struggles that they have, yeah. A lot of the loan officers that I met, I would ask them that very question. And the response was, getting them to dream, getting them to picture their life as better and kind of overcome depression and support each other is a major part of what they do.
I imagine that when you went on the second trip to see the results of mm-hmm. your investments, that you weren't staying in the kinds of places you'd stayed for Forbes.
Yeah, not so much. No. I was primarily I was staying in little, hostels or smaller places. I never went native or anything. I never actually just went and slept with the clients and in their homes or anything like that, because that would have been an incredible imposition. These folks work for like 12 hours a day, and so for them even to make an hour of their day or 2 hours to sit and talk with me, that's taking money out of their pocket. They're being very generous.
Was your return home a culture shock? Did you ever find out why you were detained at the airport?
No, I never found out. I mean, they'll never tell me. When I came back to the U.S. after all these travels, it's just a brief thing. I got stopped at the airport here in New York for a little while. Yeah, I have no idea why. Maybe there was, maybe I looked at the guy funny, or maybe it was that there were too many non-Roman scripts in my passport, too many stamps. I have no idea. But it's never been any big deal since.
Mm-hmm. He probably thought that you were meeting with insurgent groups all around the world because
of some
of the places that you went to.
Yeah.
What's the reaction when Kiva started making loans in the United States?
That's interesting. A couple of years ago.
You have to do it quickly.
Yeah. They had there's this idea of American exceptionalism, that America is fundamentally different and that we don't have poverty in America. And obviously, anybody who thinks that the United States and the developing world are really two separate things requires a certain degree of ignorance about both. Go to Appalachia, go to American Indian reservations, go to Detroit, New Orleans. You can find places in America that desperately need help. And Kiva's made a real focus in the last couple of years on getting financing into these places. When that first started, some of the Kiva lender base was outraged because Americans aren't poor. And that passed.
Bob Harris will be speaking with David Rohde tonight at 7 o'clock at the Strand Bookstore. That's at 12th Street and Broadway. His book, The International Bank of Bob, Connecting Our Worlds, $125 Kiva Loan at a Time, is published by Walker & Company. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
People listening will stop by to say hello.
Yeah, please do.